In her book, Honoring the Body, Stephanie Paulsell writes of the mending power of sexual intimacy with a story about the novelist Martin Amis.
After years of unrelenting tooth pain and disease, all of Martin's teeth were removed and replaced. In the midst of this long, excruciating process, he had to wear for several weeks a prosthetic device that filled his mouth with saliva, made it difficult for him to talk or eat, and made him feel distinctly unlovely and undesirable. In a note to his wife about the night after he had been fitted with the false teeth, he writes,
"That night, you came belly dancing out of the bathroom wearing A, your silk bathrobe, and B, my teeth. Both were then removed. This was the war against shame. The next morning, I woke early and lay there quietly laughing and weeping into the pillow. I felt fragile, guileless, and exquisitely consoled."
Fragile, guileless, and exquisitely consoled. That's a pretty good description of how we can be rendered by such intimacy with a loving partner.
Fragile, because it is always a risk to expose ourselves unguarded to another.
Guileless, because in the deepest sexual encounters, the many ways we defend ourselves, our masks, our self-deceptions, fall away.
And exquisitely consoled, to have our desire and met and satisfied by the desire of another is exquisitely consoling.
Honoring our own bodies and honoring another's body in this intimate way can lift the soul. It takes trust and courage to simply let ourselves be the sacred and vulnerable creatures that we are.
I'm so grateful to Dee and Rich for being here and for their and likely a few of your service as an OWL teacher over the years. Now, I'm not sure they said in the beginning, so just to be clear, in case you didn't get it, OWL, Our Whole Lives, is our comprehensive sexuality education program. Has anyone here been a student, an actual participant in OWL at any point? You can raise your hand. Not a parent or a kid in OWL, but an actual student. So like one. Yeah. It's interesting. Over the years, we have done a really good job addressing sexuality with our kids and youth. Conservative estimates say that over 200,000 kids have taken OWL across the country. We, on the other hand, have had an increasing reticence to address sexuality and sex with our grown-ups, especially on Sunday morning. I mean, maybe it is that we think we already know all there is to know, have all our issues worked out, that we're fine and totally shame-free. Yes? The truth is, especially given that almost all of our adults didn't go through OWL or anything like it, many of us adults are still carrying the messages about sexuality from our own childhood and youth, messages often filled with shame or ignorance. And wrapped up in these ideas are ideas about religion or God, messages that we may have rejected in theory and yet not fully transformed or reconstructed into new messages. And so we are implicitly still governed by them. Now, even if we aren't carrying this sort of baggage, we still need this sort of ongoing conversation. Sex and sexuality are a major part of life, all of life. As the opening pages of every OWL curriculum affirm, all persons are sexual. Sexuality is a good part of the human experience. And human beings are sexual from the time they are born until the time they die. As the program name, Our Whole Lives, implies, we affirm that sexuality is a lifelong journey, like faith as a whole. Our bodies change throughout our lives, our relationships change, our desires change, and life around us is changing always. The conversation and the learning, the questions, we need our own question box. It needs to happen across our whole lives, not just end at high school or college. So given that our monthly theme is desire, and Valentine's Day fell on a Sunday this year, it seemed like the perfect opportunity to catch up with our kids and explore an adult, liberal, religious ethic and theology of sex. Now, there is way more to say than I have time for today, but luckily we have many more Sundays ahead, which means we'll be having a lot more good sex sermons around here. So to begin, in many ways, the conservative fearmongers were right. Marriage has been redefined, though less by gay people than by the straight community, especially impacted by their own and their parents' divorces, as well as the equal likelihood of advanced degrees and therefore full-time career goals of both men and women. The median age for women getting married for the first time in 1980 was 22, for men, 23. Today, it's 27 and 29. Gender roles and expectations have shifted tremendously over the past few decades, although in some ways they have become even more prescribed than ever. I mean, just try to buy something pink for a newborn baby boy and see what kind of feedback you get. The easy availability of birth control and fertility treatments means the automatic correlation between heterosexual intercourse and procreation is no longer so automatic. Although I have always wondered what those who say God created sex for the purpose of making babies have to say to those who are infertile. Whether or not it was intentional, the implicit message has been to further shame and pain those who already had plenty of grief all on their own. All this means that even if we wanted to preach a no sex before marriage ethic, it's not what people will actually do, and maybe never did. Today, we talk about a hookup culture. Have you heard this term? It's a term that sociologists and journalists are using to describe an increasing acceptance of casual sex, enabled especially by dating apps and websites. This is the reality that most folks under 35 grew up with. In my experience, living together with your romantic partner without being married is not cause for scandal, but rather the expected norm. Straight people don't get all the credit for this redefinition of marriage, however. Sorry. Young adults today, almost as Dee and Rich were saying, young adults today almost universally know someone or are themselves gay. And even the most conservative usually have a generally accepting attitude. Despite all these changes, however, our cultural understanding and implicit messages around sex have not changed all that much. Sex is everywhere, but real talk about sex outside of conservative preachers prescribing healthy sex as that which occurs in heterosexual monogamous marriage remains relatively taboo. In most of the population, there is a disturbing ignorance about how bodies really work, where all the parts are, and how our bodies and our desire change throughout our lives. What's more, there remains an absurdly narrow sense of what normal sex looks like, and a perpetual dull roar, if not booming din, worry that we are the only ones who are weird, undesirable, ashamed, or confused. For example, rare is the portrayal of a sexually active female septuagenarian. It's why the Netflix show Grace and Frankie with the stunning 70-something Jane Fonda has been such a welcome revelation. Even rarer is a sexy and sexually empowered, not totally fit person, unless played for comic relief, as with Fat Amy in the Pitch Perfect movies. Sex on TV and in movies gets more and more explicit every year, and even my children have seen more than their share of erectile dysfunction ads. Seriously. But still, mainstream culture fails to portray the realities of sex. Realities like only 25% of women are consistently able to have an orgasm from vaginal intercourse. Or the fact that the average-sized woman is size 14, not 4. Unitarian Universalists created OWL with the United Church of Christ in the late 90s in response to this combination of increased sexual permissiveness and decreased lack of real knowledge, hoping to offer lots more information within an ethic grounded in liberal values and faith. As articulated in every OWL curriculum, healthy sexuality for us as religious liberals is not so different than a healthy life generally. It requires education, self-worth, consent, safety, developmental appropriateness, respect, responsibility, justice, and inclusivity. Still, I've been disappointed with the faith component of OWL in that I don't think it offers an explicit alternative to the shame-based anthropologies or cosmologies that so many of us grew up with. And so many of those old beliefs can still linger in the shadows. My hope today is to lay out one way to think about an alternative framework and the theological claims at the foundation of our liberal religious ethic. Now, planning for the service, I thought up all sorts of heady theoretical readings about sexuality. Ultimately, however, I chose the one that Dee and Rich offered because it isn't heady. It's embodied. It isn't analytical or theoretical. It's vulnerable. I mean, what gets more vulnerable than your teeth? It's vulnerable and intimate and real. Like sex. When we talk about a liberal theology and ethic of sexuality, we need to start here. Here in our vulnerable, needy bodies, here in real life, here in the struggle to navigate our embodied neediness with others in an embrace of the still possible mutual wholeness and transformation. Any theology of sex that doesn't start with the body fails to address those implicit and injuring messages many of us and our culture carry. Early Christian thinkers influenced by Plato, Aristotle, and Hellenism imagined human life dualistically, body and soul separate. The soul was eternal and of God, and guess what? The body was sinful and to be overcome in service of saving the soul. In the 17th century, the philosopher René Descartes further systematized this division, promoting a dualism of mind and body. Descartes, the one that proclaimed, "I think, therefore I am." The brain means you are a person in this system. Your body, inconsequential, incidental, secondary, problematic, so messy, something to be controlled or managed in service of the real you, your mind. Now, feminist, queer, and other progressive philosophers and theologians finally and thankfully critiqued this dualism, and science has actually revealed its flaws. A liberal theological anthropology, that is an understanding of the human person, refuses to separate the parts in any way, but rather approaches humanity, the human person, as one of body, one of mind, one of spirit, all one. And all fundamentally good. All connected, all alive, indivisible, all gifts of God or of the universe, all worthy of love and belonging, inherently so, as we say. The body is not something to be overcome in this framework, but it is rather to be honored, respected, loved. Its regular workings and needs are not shameful or dirty or requiring purification or containment. Bodies are funny, mysterious, beautiful, messy, and changing, as humans are funny, mysterious, beautiful, messy, and changing. That bodies become hungry for food or for touch is simply true, not good or bad, just true. That bodies take pleasure in food or touch is also true, still not inherently good or bad, just true. In this theology of the body, we affirm the goodness of aligning the spirit, the mind, the body, such that we refuse a strict gender binary dictated by outward cultural norms. We find gender policing unethical, affirm trans identity, and embrace all sorts of gender expression, traditional, non-traditional, everything in between. That is, our theology seeks authenticity and the liberation of all of our spirits in service of truth and a greater love, whatever clothes or name or pronoun that might go by. Most of all, bodies, as they are indivisibly life, humanity, personhood, are vulnerable, as all life is vulnerable. We go to great lengths to control and avoid this reality, to assert and appear otherwise, but all of us are so terribly vulnerable. We are all susceptible to injury, illness, aging. Our hearts hurt literally or figuratively, often both, and often the distinction is imperceptible. Open heart surgery leaves most people readily emotional, more easily teary-eyed, and often profoundly changed and transformed. This causes some confusion and resistance to some post-surgery, but it makes perfect sense to me. Your heart was broken, exposed, and then put back together anew. No doubt things are going to be a little on the surface for a while, maybe for the rest of your heart's beating life. Bodies that hurt can also be healed, and because bodies, minds, and spirits are one, the hurt may show itself in the teeth, yet the pain will be felt everywhere, distinctly unlovely and undesirable. So too the healing everywhere, exquisitely consoled. In the midst of all the ways that life tears us apart, sex can pull our pieces back together, tenderly, clumsily, beautifully. And when it does, whether in the context of casual or committed relationships, sex can be holy and sacred. Still, let us not fail to acknowledge that vulnerability is another word for risk. Sex is risky, emotionally, physically, spiritually. Sex does not always leave us exquisitely consoled. Sometimes it is the thing we need to be consoled about. As one of my favorite thinkers on sex advice columnist Dan Savage puts it, there is no such thing as risk-free sex. Conservatives tend to blow these risks out of proportion, resulting in abstinence-only education and anti-abortion hysteria. Liberals tend to minimize these same risks by way of condoms and the pill. Acknowledging that all sex involves risks of some sort helps us right-size our risk assessments, and decide if we can truly live with those risks. And obviously, this sort of risk assessment is best done outside the heat of the moment, through ongoing conversation, reflection, even prayer. Some feminist philosophers idealize an ethical framework that disconnects sex from risk entirely, imagining that somehow we may disentangle pleasure from danger. However, I tend to agree with the perspective of those who, like Jewish feminist Rebecca Alpert, finds this an impossible task. Acknowledging, as she does, that love may be gentle and kind, but passion isn't always. Recognizing the dangerous dimension of sexual desire can enable people to find creative ways to work with that. That is, if we don't name the risk and danger of sexuality, it goes underground. spurred on by shame and ignorance. These are the seeds for abuse and dysfunction, which we have seen so terribly, for example, in clergy sexual abuse and misconduct across all denominations, including our own. Some of you lived through Unitarian Universalism in the 1970s, so you may have firsthand memories of the ways that a number of clergy pointed to the permissive culture around them to excuse their own sexual experiments rather than acknowledging the special danger their behavior posed given their role as a minister. Pretending there was no special risk meant the risk was even greater, and many of our churches have spent the last few decades finding their way out of the devastating consequences. Understanding sexuality as an expression of embodied vulnerability with the potential for both danger and healing, the inevitable ethic invites us to consider how our sexual choices can foster the latter rather than the former. Now, to help with this, I want to turn to a phrase that you might more easily expect to hear in a more traditional conservative sermon on sexuality, which is to affirm that sex is intended for creative purposes. Of course, our conservative counterparts would add the modifier pro before creative, that is, sex is for pro-creation. In our liberal religious ethic, however, we like a little less prescription, so we'll simply say that sex is for creation. As we navigate the rights and wrongs of sexuality, we might ask ourselves whether or not the sexual expression will be creative or destructive, life-affirming or life-denying. And given our theology, we need to ask this not just for ourselves in the moment, but also for our partner and our whole webs of relationships, for life as a whole. This liberal religious perspective differs from the liberal secular standard of whatever consulting adults choose to do is fine, in favor of an ethic that clearly defines good sex as that which heals, reconstructs, co-creates, and connects, and defines bad sex as that which destroys, denies, and separates, sometimes in one singular moment, but more often over time, little by little, chipping away at wholeness and relationship. Now, you may have noticed that not much in what I've laid out provides a list of rules. This act being good, this one being bad. I mean, meaningful consent and awareness of power are good starting points. But beyond this, we acknowledge that context always matters, and the changing, growing nature of the person matters. What was one day life-affirming and creative may another day be life-denying, and so we make different choices in service always of life. Importantly, the sexual ethic affirms the potential goodness in same-sex partners as well as non-monogamous partners and allows us to affirm all sorts of sex acts and no sex acts as healthy and perfectly normal. As long as any of these create rather than destroy life, and as long as they keep the whole person and the whole web of life in view, all of it can be good. Love, desire, bodies, and life are messy and unpredictable, capable of bringing so much pain and so much good. Sexuality and all of life cannot be made otherwise, regardless of the ethical system or theological framework we might employ. As humans in this great enterprise of life, we can only hope to be aware and awake to these risks of sex, of love, of living at all, and the possibility in the most intimate and grandest possible scale for both healing and devastation, and try our best to partner with life or with God in creating more life, more love, and more good. And we give thanks. Amen. Blessed be.